Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're looking at the relationship between Turkey's Kilis province and Syria's Afrin district, specifically in the years leading up to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
We've gathered quite a bit of research and analysis to explore what those connections look like in this borderland before all the major changes brought on by the Syrian uprising.
Yeah, it's a really interesting period to focus on, sort of a moment of relative quiet before everything shifted so dramatically.
Exactly. And our aim here is to really understand the key parts of that relationship during that specific time, a time when there was actually quite a bit of cooperation.
Right. Getting a baseline, essentially.
Yeah. So first things first, maybe we should talk about how this border actually, you know, came to be.
Good place to start.
Our sources trace it back to the Ottoman Empire. Back then, both Kilis and Afrin were part of the Aleppo Vilayet.
And Afrin was actually administered from Kilis, which is quite interesting.
Right. Then fast forward to the early 20th century, and you have treaties like the Treaty of Ankara in 1921 and then Lausanne in 1923.
And those treaties, while they fundamentally changed the map, they drew the line,
yeah,
severing those old administrative links you mentioned.
So Afrin ends up in French Mandate Syria. Kilis stays with the new Turkish Republic.
Precisely.
And this wasn't just lines on a map, was it? The sources really emphasize how the Kurdish population saw this.
Oh, absolutely. For many Kurds, these treaties were a disaster, basically dividing their homeland between these new countries.
Some sources even call Lausanne a historical injustice because it didn't really account for Kurdish hopes for, you know, self-determination.
A really key perspective to keep in mind. It wasn't seen as a legitimate border by everyone living there.
And did the sources mention how this division played out on the ground early on, beyond just the political lines?
Well, yeah. I mean, besides fragmenting communities, Turkey started taking steps pretty early to solidify that border. We're talking the 1960s.
Like what?
Fencing went up, minefields were laid. Minefields, wow.
Yeah. And even martial law sometimes, mainly to clamp down on cross-border movement and, importantly, smuggling.
Which brings us nicely to the next point. The people on either side, the demographics just before 2010, they seem quite different.
Very different, yes.
So Kilis province, it only became its own province in 1995, right?
Yeah.
It had a population around, what, 120,000, maybe 130,000?
Yeah, in that range, yeah. And ethnically quite mixed. A Turkish majority, sure, but also a significant Kurdish minority. What did the sources say? Nationally, around 19%?
Something like that, yeah. And an Arab presence, too.
And if you look back further, historically, Kilis town itself was even more diverse.
Yeah.
You had Turkomans, Armenians, Kurds, Osmanlis, Arabs, Circassians, even Jews.
Though, as often happened, the non-Muslim population dwindled significantly over the 20th century.
That's right. Did the sources give much detail on how those groups interacted back then, before the big shifts?
Not a huge amount in what we looked at for this period, focusing more on the pre-2010 era.
Mm-hmm.
But then you look across the border, just a few miles away, to Afrin, part of Syria's Aleppo governorate then.
Right. Population figures vary a bit. The 2004 census said around 172,000, but a 2010 estimate was much higher, maybe over 500,000.
The numbers can be tricky, but the key thing, the really striking thing about Afrin.
The Kurdish majority.
Exactly. Overwhelmingly Kurdish,
right?
Like 95, maybe 97%. It's historically part of the region known as Kurd Dag, the mountain of the Kurds.
So a very strong Kurdish identity there.
Definitely. Though there were smaller groups too, Arabs, Turkmen, Yazidis, and some Kurdish-speaking Alevis.
And interestingly, Afrin kind of avoided the Arabization policies that the Syrian government pushed in other Kurdish areas, didn't it? Before 2011, anyway.
It largely did, yeah. Which helped preserve that distinct Kurdish character. So you have this really stark demographic contrast right across a border that, as we said, many Kurds didn't really view as legitimate.
Okay, so you've got this history, this border, these different populations. What kind of interaction was happening across that line before 2010? Smuggling seems like a big part of the story.
Oh, huge.
Yeah.
For a long time, the shadow economy, especially smuggling, was just, well, part of life there. Some estimates suggest its value actually exceeded the legal trade along the whole Syrian-Turkish border at one point.
Really? What kind of stuff are we talking about?
All sorts. Consumer goods, definitely. Gold, foreign currency, shuffling between Beirut, Kilis, Istanbul. Subsidized goods were big, too. Syrian fuel, tea, tobacco.
Because of price differences, I assume?
Exactly. Price differences, regulations. And historically, you haven't had livestock and weapons moving across.
And how did they do it? I mean, with the fences and minefields you mentioned?
Pretty resourceful methods. You had porters, Kachakshis who knew the terrain, even the minefield paths.
Wow. Risking their lives.
Absolutely. Then you had trucks with hidden compartments, people finding ways around customs checks.
And kinship networks were key. Family ties across the border.
Crucial. Those networks provided the trust, the connections needed for this kind of illicit trade. It wasn't just about profit either.
Also.
Well, for many people in Keeley's, especially when formal jobs were scarce, smuggling was a lifeline. It was how you made a living, maybe even improved your social standing.
So it really shaped the place?
Literally. It shaped the town's economy, its landscape. You had warehouses, arcades built for this trade. Keeley's even got the nickname Little Beirut because its informal market was so vibrant.
Huh. Little Beirut. Oh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roach Bosch. Hannah. Let's see. Takes a sip. You know, today's chai is a little bitter. It definitely needs more sugar.
Oh, really? Let me try. Yeah, maybe just a touch.
Let's take a quick break to add some. We'll be right back.
That's good. Brief pause simulation.
Okay, welcome back. We've sweetened the chai.
Much better.
So we were talking about this very active informal economy, the smuggling culture in Keeley's, but then things started to change in the 2000s, didn't they?
They really did. There was a significant period of rapprochement between Turkey and Syria at the national level.
A thawing of relations.
Exactly. You had some major steps, like the free trade agreement signed in 2007, and then, really importantly, they abolished visa requirements in 2009.
It must have been huge for people on the ground.
Absolutely. And politically, you saw lots of high-level visits, joint cabinet meetings becoming, you know, almost normal.
And this directly impacted the Keeley's-Afrin border area.
Definitely. Formal trade between the two countries just exploded. It went from something like $600 million in 98 to $2.3 billion by 2010.
Wow, that's a massive jump. What was driving that? What kind of goods?
Well, Turkey became a big exporter to Syria, things like manufactured goods, textiles, machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And Syria exported more raw materials, agricultural products.
So new economic opportunities.
For sure. Businesses expanded, cross-border investment grew. It impacted jobs, local economies right there in Keeley's and across in Syria.
And the visa liberalization, people moving across more.
Dramatically. Turkish visitors going to Syria jumped from maybe 170,000 a year to almost 1.5 million.
And Syrians coming to Turkey.
Similar story. From around 100,000 to 900,000, the Unchepinar border crossing right there in Keeley's became incredibly busy.
But did this formal trade, this easier travel, did it actually stop the smuggling? Or did change it?
That's the interesting question. The sources suggest it probably didn't eliminate it entirely. It likely coexisted. Maybe the increased legitimate traffic even provided, you know, some cover for the informal stuff to continue in new ways.
Makes sense. And socially, those kinship ties we talked about must have gotten a real boost with people able to visit family easily after 2009.
Without a doubt. Imagine families separated for years by that border, suddenly able to cross freely for visits, for weddings, funerals. It must have strengthened those personal and commercial links enormously.
Even with the different demographics, Turkish-Kurdish majority in Keeley's, overwhelmingly Kurdish in Afrin, there were probably shared customs too.
Yeah, shared regional things, maybe some lingering Ottoman cultural overlaps. But Afrin also kept its very distinct Kurdish culture, its Sufi traditions. The visa change just made connecting easier.
Okay, what about agriculture? You mentioned Afrin is famous for olives, something like 18 million trees.
Yeah, a huge number. Olive cultivation is central to Afrin's identity and economy.
And Keeley's grows olives too, plus grapes, pistachios. Was there much agricultural connection across the border before 2010, like trade in produce or seasonal workers?
You know, it's interesting, but the sources we reviewed didn't actually detail much direct agricultural exchange specifically between Keeley's and Afrin in that period.
Oh.
Yeah, not compared to the smuggling or the later refugee movements. It doesn't mean it didn't happen on a smaller scale, maybe locally, but it wasn't highlighted as a major cross-border link in the materials we examined for this time frame.
Huh. Okay. So let's zoom out a bit then to the bigger political picture between Turkey and Syria before 2010. You mentioned the shift from confrontation to cooperation. That seems critical.
Absolutely critical. Because for a long time, relations were really bad. Late 20th century, you had Cold War divisions, disputes over water, the whole Harare issue.
And Syria's support for the PKK, right? That was a major sticking point for Turkey.
The biggest one. It almost led to war in 1998. Turkey basically threatened military action.
But then they reached the Adana Accord in October 98.
That was the turning point. Syria agreed to stop supporting the PKK, expelled Öcalan, that removed the main obstacle.
So what drove the improvement in the 2000s? Why did they become friendlier?
Several things came together. Shared security worries, especially about the rise of Kurdish autonomy in Iraq after 2003. Both Ankara and Damascus were wary of that.
Okay, a shared concern.
Then strong economic interests. Turkey wanted new markets, Syria needed investment, and a way to connect to the global economy.
And geopolitics.
Yeah. Turkey was pushing its zero problems with neighbors policy under the AKP government. And Syria, facing international isolation, saw Turkey as a potential bridge.
And this cooperation at the top level really manifested right there at the border.
It really did. We mentioned the trade and visa stuff, but there were other things too. High-level visits became routine. Joint cabinet meetings.
Even military cooperation.
Amazingly, yes. There was actually a joint Turkish-Syrian military exercise near Kilis in 2010. Think about that, given the tensions just a decade earlier.
That's quite a symbol.
And you had the governors of Kilis and Aleppo talking directly through this cross-border cooperation program. They were discussing things like building a joint emergency response center on the road between Aleppo and the Zaz.
So the national thaw really enabled or even encouraged this local level interaction and cooperation.
Exactly. It built on top of those existing social ties and the informal economy that had been there all along.
So looking back at this whole pre-2010 picture, it's quite complex. You've got the historical divisions from the border's creation, especially for Kurds. You've got these contrasting demographics side by side.
Then this incredibly strong smuggling economy, almost a defining feature for Kilis for a long time.
But then layered onto that, this unique decade of political opening, of formal trade booming, people crossing easily, even joint projects being discussed.
It's a fascinating mix.
It really is. And understanding these dynamics, this specific setup before 2010, feels pretty crucial for making sense of everything that happened after the Syrian civil war began.
Absolutely. It provides that essential context.
So thinking about that context, if you had to maybe highlight one or two things from this pre-war relationship for our listeners to really hold on to when they think about the conflict years and the situation now, what would stand out to you?
Good question. I mean, perhaps the deep roots of the informal economy and those cross-border kinship networks, they didn't just disappear when formal relations improved or when conflict erupted. They adapted, they persisted, and likely played significant roles later on, maybe in unexpected ways.
Right, that resilience. And maybe also the memory of that period of cooperation. Does that linger or is it totally overshadowed now?
That's harder to say. But the fact that such cooperation was possible, even briefly after decades of hostility, is maybe worth remembering. It shows how quickly dynamics can shift in the region, for better or worse.
Yeah. It's an intricate history, isn't it? Really makes you think about how these borderlands work, how local life gets tangled up with big national and international politics. Lots to reflect on there.